Hi, this is Charles on democraticfundamentalism.org. First, I want to welcome those of you linking in to democraticfundamentalism.org from other sites. I do my best to provide links to relevant news stories on other sites to provide you with independent verification of what I talk about. As I always say, you don't have to take my word for anything. I don't have to make this stuff up. I really don't. I want to mention and congratulate Jimmy Carter on receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. That was really great. I view Jimmy Carter as the first original cultural creative of modern times. He was a brilliant man, a nuclear scientist before he got into politics, I might add. Someday I hope to have the privilege to talk to him a little bit and have him tell me a little bit about his vision about some things he designed for the world that never got implemented. I also want to do my weekly disclaimer about CNN. We've never talked or anything quite that rational. But I've been a news hound for years. I love to know all the details. So often we hear the headlines of news, headlines that sort of contradict the content of the story. So it's like always remember that headlines are made to get your attention, not inform you. Anyway, so I finally started watching CNN a lot, and once I got cable and decided after a while they gave me the most information. Personally, I love the scroller at the bottom of the screen. It tells you about the breaking news. After all, the announcers don't have time to tell you every story on the air. And they just upgraded their website, too. It's great. So, as I always say, I make no apologies about fully recommending them to you. And yes, there are plenty of other news sources worthy of your time, like Time.com, The Village Voice, The New York Times, Washington Post, what is it, the Chicago Sun-Herald? Is that what it is? You never know. But I like CNN, and it's my website here, so unless they have their attorney sending me a letter to tell me to stop, I'm going to continue recommending them and verbally poking fun at their announcers as long as I feel like it. It's actually my favorite part. Always say stuff like that. I wonder if they even read this stuff. One of their announcers actually quoted Elvis Costello the other day on the air. It ain't rap, but it was music. Anyway, took me about a week to get it, but I finally did. And the line was, at first I was disgusted, and then I was amused. I'll bet it's amended to, I was disgusted again. When you think about it, it really does speak to the absurdity of life. How we all get worked up emotionally about things that in the final analysis are valid considerations, but not really what's important. The logical level, it's sort of a study of what it means to be human. We all have icons and symbols in life that give us guidance that disturb us, and that's a good thing. But we give them more significance than they really deserve. I talk about people all the time as mentors and father figures and mother figures and uncles and aunts and, you know, brothers I'd never had, role models and stuff, you know? It's very Jungian. Not really about them personally. Although in my world it generates some affection, but it's really just about finding things and people and philosophies you admire, traits and skills, stuff like that, appreciating them and learning from them. It's that simple. It's like I like growing flowers as much as I like chopping wood and working on cars. Anyway, so the point is that there's an old French phrase that goes sort of like this. What you resist, persists. And if as James Taylor sings, the secret of life is truly enjoying the passage of time, and all sorts of good and bad things happen, in the end, all there is to do about it is accept it and carry on. Whether you like it or not really becomes irrelevant, because whatever it is, it is. Like, if there's a big rock in the road, you have to either choose to move it or run over it and maybe do some damage to your tires. Either way, regardless of the damage done, it exists, and nothing will change that. And so you deal with it and move on. Believe it or not, that leads me to the next thing, which is to talk a little bit about the sniper shootings occurring in the Washington, D.C. area. It really is upsetting. I used to live and work in the areas of Rockville where some of the shootings occurred. I have many friends there, and I originally left the area partly because there were signs of things like this beginning to occur a few years back, but certainly nothing of this level or danger or intensity. I feel bad for my friends. My prayers are with them. I'll read you some of the story from CNN so you're up to date with some of the latest facts as of this writing. Of course, the link is right there in the text for you to go to their website, CNN.com. Montgomery County Police have issued a composite drawing of a second vehicle they're looking for as they attempt to close the net on the D.C. area sniper. Police Chief Charles Moose released the composite of a white box-type truck that witnesses have seen near four of the shooting locations. Law enforcement officers say they have a description of the two people reported inside the van being sought. We do have a number of leads, and from the scene this morning, we developed additional information that we'll be following up on and hopefully will be productive, that according to Virginia State Police Colonel W. Gerald Massengill. I'll add my own comment about one thing. Given that the police have released a composite of the vehicle for people to look for, it means that everyone will be looking at white trucks and ignoring other vehicles. All I or these people have to do is change vehicles and no one will notice. And what if the white truck is mainly a decoy? It's like John Travolta in the movie Swordfish. The name of the game is misdirection, and whether or not the people doing this are citizens gone crazy or international terrorists, it's all just part of the ripple effect I'll talk about in a few minutes. Somebody, though, has come up with a perverse plan, probably a demented pair, who have decided to take it upon themselves to take the world by force, using the tarot death card to scare people, which is not about killing or dying, it's about changing in the end of one thing and the creation of something new. And it's all done in ways to disrupt our lives, place us in fear, and make us feel threatened. While our attention is placed on the terrorists, our country readies and deploys our military in Iraq and other places, the whole rest of the world is protesting in the streets against the United States and our aggressive military policies. And meanwhile, a ship was bombed in Yemen, troops are being attacked in Kuwait, a blast in Bali has killed more than 100 people, an entire city block was destroyed. We're lied to about what is really occurring in Iraq in regard to chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. We're told that Iraq is capable of creating atomic weapons within, well, sometimes we're told a year, sometimes 10 years. None of the answers given would lead you to believe that there's any true urgency in going to war in Iraq. And about why now, Republican leaders typically respond with the answer, why not now? And the Bush administration claims that Iraq is guilty of deception. They say Iraq did bioweapons testing on its people. It's part of what supposedly makes Saddam such a bad person. Well, guess what? So did the United States in the 60s, in Hawaii, among other places. We'll talk about that in the next report, too. But that's where we're headed to war. And I assure you that's what the Bush administration will do no matter what, unless we take action to force this government to deal with the more urgent needs of the individual American citizens and our economy, instead of spending hundreds of billions of dollars to kill a man so that the man we call president, with the power of our government and military behind him, even if by illegal means, can finally overcome his insecurities and get his father's approval by making him and his rich friends wealthier when they rebuild and acquire the resources of Iraq. Hypothetical upon hypothetical, of course, right, Don? At least I admit it. I just think of how the people of Iraq and the people of America are going to have to deal with the hardship while the military and industrial complex gets richer. And all those people who protested and were against the Vietnam War and were lied to about the Gulf of Tonkin. That was a case when we attacked them secretly, and then when they retaliated, we told the world that they attacked us first, and thusly justified escalation of the military activities of the Vietnam War. Government lied to us about having been attacked first. Now, I don't mean to glorify Osama bin Laden or terrorism at all, but the recent Al-Qaeda tapes broadcast on Al Jazeera clearly stated that their opinion is that the actions of Al-Qaeda were responsive, not aggressive. It's worth looking into more, if only to understand their frustration with American foreign policy and exploitative and dangerous corporate practices in their countries. It's all a part of the economic war we became involved in many years ago. I wish Americans would be willing to understand other people's points of view more. We've somehow lost that. That's why I always liked the flower children at the marches and protests during the Vietnam War. It was one of the finest symbols of how the protesters didn't view the police as the enemy. They just had a difference of opinion, but that it didn't diminish anybody's value or dignity as people. I really like that. It's all pretty sad, though. What we have to accept, though, is the rippling effect that has occurred in our nation, that has spread to the world, and it mainly began because of the Florida 2000 debacle. Now, I'm not accusing Bush for the sniper situation. I want to remind you that the basic history of the Bush administration, well, it actually begins with Bill Clinton. That will, remark will spin some heads, but don't jump to conclusions. The important thing is to get the pattern. The frustration caused by the election caused a tension throughout the country. Civil rights, which had been so long suffered for, were set back by years by the way Florida handled the election and turned away some 150,000 voters from the polls based on information that was not only known to be faulty, but which was generated from a computer system based on improper and illegal criteria. The query was knowingly asking for the wrong data. And little meaningful or tangible action was taken that could ever right the wrong of the election of 2000, and the reason why is simple. The people involved in the conspiracy were in charge of the American justice system. Bill Clinton had masterfully controlled the economy in such a way that profits and stock market earnings were high, and Americans were prosperous, and business was good. But even before Bush took office, he and his friends began talking about how bad the economy was going. And while Americans were walking around scratching their heads saying, "Huh? What are they talking about? Are they talking the economy into a recession with pessimism?" The economy held strong. Until finally, September 11th, 2001, two planes slammed into the World Trade Center towers, one into the Pentagon and another one down in Pennsylvania. All of that was a tragedy in itself. But since then, our nation has been subjected to financial scandal, but more the result of an increasingly deceptive world of business personal conduct that sets up facades, images, in order to cover the truth, the embarrassment of failure and the fear they have of being discovered for their weaknesses and mistakes. Before long, the house of cards begins to fall, as has the stock market. Many people are actually having to delay their retirements for years because of the corporate scandals. And still, Ken Lay's name is rarely ever heard. Remember him? Many people are close to running out of unemployment benefits. Fortunately, Senator Gene Carnahan used the Democratic radio address today to call for extension of the unemployment benefits. Our forests are being burned, and Bush refuses to work with other countries in preventing it. The coal-powered electric generating plants and vehicle pollution are causing many national parks to have worse air pollution than many major cities. And these are the same plants that Bush's environmental policies relieved of cleaning up their emissions because it would cost them too much money. Keep imagining the day when the wild animals will all be kept in little pens and managed instead of being allowed to roam free. And they would be caged because if they were let out, they would die. Remember a George Carlin routine when he was saying, "The earth doesn't care if you pollute. The earth itself will go on just fine. It's the people and the plants and the animals that'll be pissed off." That's what he said. He's right. And now, our government will likely invade Iraq. They said Iraq was in cahoots with Al-Qaeda, then they said Iraq wasn't. They deceived us again, like in the Gulf of Tonkin. The economy is in bad shape. The people of America are beginning to feel the pain. And yet our government is willing to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. One of the old accepted policies of the military and industrial complex and the Republican Party has been, when the economy goes sour, start a war. It's true. It's an age-old policy of the old-style political machines. It's not just in the United States. But they aren't creative enough to consider that if they spent all that money on making friends, doing good things in the world, we wouldn't need wars. It's all part of the ripple effect. It brings me to the case of O.J. Simpson. And you're probably saying, but the O.J. thing didn't happen, you know, it happened before George Bush took office, and you'd be right. But it's the ripple effect I'm actually talking about. How, like the leaders of our communities, set the tone for conduct, for the moral fabric of our society, and how that ripples down, trickles down into our lives. The case of O.J. had more to do with racial prejudice, the destruction of other people's lives for political gain and financial gain, the destruction of the image of a role model in the African-American community. There have been many such cases of reducing the image of role models and minorities, and it's no real accident. It's all about domination, suppression, and oppression. Just as the NAACP has become suppressed by the threat of removal of its tax-exempt status, if it continues to speak out for African Americans and their minorities. It's about a rush to judgment and evidence tampering and testifying and expediency and police officers issuing their own brand of justice based on their opinions and not the law. But first, let's take a seventh inning stretch for a minute. Just close your eyes, relax, take a few deep breaths, think about a beautiful sunny day. Being with the people you love, being the places you love most. Imagine it's a whole new world. All you have to do is want it. It's true. I feel better. Let's take a look at entertainment news, something a little bit lighter. Let's see, a few things. I always laugh at Madonna. She's so real. I have to admit I really didn't like the message of Material Girl. She has some great music, though. A lot of people can crank out hits, but her music is incredible as well. She's got that new movie out called Swept Away. Looks fun. She was on Larry King Live the other night, and I thought it was funny how she adapts to everything put before her. She talked about how her life now is about her husband and her child. According to her, Madonna says, "My priority is my family." Incidentally, as I write this, John McCain is on tonight's show of Larry King. He's got a new book out called Worth Fighting For, and it's worth buying. He was talking about a number of things like ethics and heritage. John McCain is one of those guys who I don't always agree with, but I know if I had to sit down and figure out the best way to do something, we'd have different opinions, but we'd find that better way to do it. He's a fair man, an incredible example of a statesman and a patriot. I really think he's great. In my mind, he, like, oh, I don't know, Ted Kennedy and many other American statesmen and women, they're examples of why there should not be term limits. The check and balance of the system is when voters go to the polls each election, having been informed, and choose new people. If it works, don't fix it. If it's broke, replace it. It's that simple. We all need to make sure we get out and vote. Get John's book, though, too. It's called Worth the Fighting For. I just couldn't even begin to tell you all the great things he talks about. He's truly a great man. Music. Let's see. I was sitting here listening to Peter Gabriel's album called Up. I know it's just a coincidence, but it's the one I listen to when I want to know what's going to happen next in my life. Well, I can't quite imagine what the Barry Williams show thing is about. They're actually making a TV show out of that song. It's kind of backwards and bizarre, but it'll be interesting. Anyway, the new Bon Jovi album is out. It's pretty tasty. It's called Bounce. It's neat how with every CD you get a PIN number that gives you access to a special area of his website. All kinds of interesting stuff behind that green door. Springsteen's The Rising, still one of my favorites, is the album from the old guy, you know, Jim Bob, the guy with the hat. You know, James Taylor, October Road. One of these days I'll get around to the new Jackson Brown CD, too. Little message to Mick Jagger. Mick, millions of people love those old sentimental songs. I, myself, am one of the fans of them. I have to say to you, is just like, humble yourself to the masses, my friend. Appreciate it. It's love, man. All you need is love. It's okay that the Beatles wrote one of those hits for you. That'll win me some points someday, huh? Don't forget to watch Everwood, 9 p.m. Eastern on Mondays. I love that show. Also on the WB, a favorite new show. It's really great. It's cool. Birds of Prey. I think that's 9 p.m. Wednesdays. Interestingly enough, got to get the VCR out, or TiVo. 9 p.m. Wednesdays on the Discovery Channel is a cool show called Unsolved History. That's where historians go back in time and solve famous mysteries, such as how King Tut was murdered and how the Civil War was won because of a wooden fence. Interesting show. Also want to do a special acknowledgement to the great work of John Stossel over at ABC. He's actually more of an educator, as far as I can tell. Doesn't surprise me with a name like that. He really does the great segments on ABC's 2020 program with Barbara Walters. His segment is called Give Me a Break, and they let him do some specials sometimes too. John, great job. Be on the lookout for Odyssey 5. It's about some people who go out into space, and while they're there, the world blows up, and some aliens come along and tell them they'll set time back 5 years so they can try to fix what went wrong before we all destroy ourselves again. I think it's on HBO or Showtime. I like it because in many ways it's like what I'm up to in the world, changing the future just like them, really. That's how I see it. You gotta try thinking of it that way. It could make all the difference in the world. Think about it. A while back, I told you of a man named James Twyman who was going to Iraq to sing religious and spiritual music and lead a prayer vigil for peace. For doing that, his life was threatened numerous times, and the United States government informed him that upon his return to the United States, he would be arrested. Imagine that, going to a foreign country to sing songs for peace will get you arrested. A ridiculous thing. Bush and company are going too far again. It's truly idiotic. Some fun news. Motown is putting on a Christmas special on the USA Channel. It'll include Stevie Wonder, I Was Made to Love You, Temptations, India Arie. They'll be in that show and early December. I think it's USA Network. It's going to be a great show. I know it's excellent artists. Let's talk about O.J. now. You may indeed wonder why. It's because of the way some cases seem to be handled in Southern California and other places for that matter. The lack of interest in seeking other suspects, tampering with evidence, racism, profiteering, and political jockeying that subverts the system of justice. People who think O.J. is guilty think the Dream Team got him off. I say they worked diligently to free an innocent man and expose the arrogance of police officers who take the law into their own hands by testifying. I'll admit, for me, listening to Johnny Cochran is like hearing a good sermon in church on Sundays. F. Lee Bailey, he's great. Robert Shapiro, he's great. They're all great. They really are. They're all great. But because of my scientific nature at times, I was most impressed with Barry Scheck, an attorney who used science in the form of DNA evidence and other state-of-the-art techniques that ultimately will help revolutionize DNA forensics for the purpose of greater certainty in the prosecution of crimes and making sure free people remain free. That was what the Dream Team was about. Team of people and support personnel capable of beating what was either a conspiracy against O.J. or just plain criminal incompetence. And I believe it all relates directly to the case of Robert Blake, who says that tampering is part of his arrest and incarceration while awaiting trial as well. A long incarceration for something that hasn't been proven, is based on loose circumstantial evidence, and for a crime with many likely suspects who were never fully investigated. It's about time lost that can be never recovered. It's about money spent that's wasted on defense in a system bound and determined to win, no matter how the facts are twisted. It most certainly wasn't about justice. As I always say about it, if I had been on the jury of that trial, it would have only taken me 2 minutes to acquit him, and that it could only have taken 30 minutes because they had to go to the bathroom and get a drink of water and stretch before voting on the verdict. When I first heard that O.J. was suspected and then later arrested for the murder of Ron Goldman and Nicole, I was truly sad. But I reminded myself that good people do stupid things sometimes. And otherwise, he was a hero, someone to be respected and proud of. For the American, or for the African-American community, especially kids, he was a true role model. He made a huge contribution to the very organizations he assisted and those who benefited from their services. Wasn't all that impressed with his acting, frankly, but he was great in Police Squad with Leslie Nielsen. I'm a Nielsen fan, too. Dramatic in comedy. Anyway, back to O.J. I actually said to myself, although I couldn't believe it, I didn't want to believe it, I'm willing to have them honestly prove to me that O.J. did it and just accept the verdict. That's why I watched the entire trial, every minute of it, because I'm still a big fan of O.J.'s, and I wanted them to prove it to me. They didn't even begin to. I was going to give you a huge report full of references, spent a lot of time on it, but I thought I can tell you more succinctly because I watched every minute of the trial that was on TV, and it was a lot. It would have taken hours to explain it all to you. Everybody talks about the Dream Team, how it was about buying attorneys who could manipulate the system. The truth is, it took the Dream Team to expose the corruption that led to the arrest of O.J. in this justice system. And mind you, I don't want to minimize the loss and tragedy and horror of the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. It was a terrible thing. But there were many avenues to pursue, including the realistic possibility of a drug-related murder having nothing to do with O.J. Simpson, things that were completely disregarded. And it was no secret that O.J. and Nicole had a stormy relationship. The way the events were portrayed, Simpson and Cato Kalin would have gone out to get a hamburger. Then he would have had to go to Nicole Brown Simpson's place, nearly decapitate Nicole Brown Simpson, and then struggle with Ron Goldman and kill him, then go back past the area where Nicole was, leaving a footprint from a Bruno Mali shoe in a puddle on the ground. And then he would have run up some steps and out a gate to the street, gotten into his infamous Bronco, driven home, gone around to the back of the property, gone over a fence, and then, having supposedly tripped or something, banged into the back of Cato Kalin's bungalow. Cato said it startled him. That, of course, would have drawn attention to the area behind the bungalow. Then Simpson supposedly would have gone into the house, changed clothing, washed up, contained evidence, and then met a limousine driver outside his home to go to the airport and catch a flight to Chicago. The things that struck me most about those events were these. First, Cato Kalin said that when he went out with Simpson to get a hamburger, Simpson seemed perfectly fine. That may or may not be a clue. The bang on the back of Kalin's bungalow was a little too obvious. That was where the infamous bloody gloves were found as well. By the description of the noise by Kalin, the noise would have been more likely from someone slapping the wall very hard with a hand or an implement, rather than the sound of someone tripping and banging into it. The Dream Team never brought that up. There is no other evidence presented regarding witnessing any other signs of travel through that area of the yard, such as signs of someone running or rushing or walking through. Yeah, I watched the whole thing very carefully. I took notes. I empathized with Judge Lancito during the sidebars. Anyway, after Simpson had left for the airport, Kalin allowed police into Simpson's mansion. And on the premises, they were concerned for the safety of O.J., supposedly looking for evidence of a struggle or, you know, blood or, you know, any kind of thing that would suggest that something was irregular. And that was, of course, in case someone had decided to kill them both. There was no report of any blood evidence in the house at that time. The next day, there were blood spots found in the foyer of the home where the police would have walked through the night before. The Dream Team never brought that up either. But the Bronco parked out in front of O.J.'s house had bloodstains in it, according to the police, and that's when the focus was put on O.J. and no one else. It may not have been a conspiracy against O.J., but it most certainly became a conspiracy to cover reprehensible behavior by certain police officers who rendered the possibility of certainty about the accurate analysis of evidence by the lack of processing protocol. And that was to ensure that there was no contamination or addition of unrelated materials, that protocol was. They were walking over bloodstains at the murder scene. They didn't even have the discipline to set the date and time on the video camera so it would contain a reliable reference of when the tape was made. It made the investigative process hard to take seriously. And that, of course, is from an objective, non-biased view. Announcements were even made in public that socks with blood evidence were found that didn't exist. And the glove? Cochran was right on the mark. He declared, "If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit." And the glove didn't fit. In the trial, Simpson wore a thin plastic glove while trying it on. Then in his jail cell, they tried it with and without a plastic glove, and it didn't fit. And they were supposed to have been custom-fit gloves. And even I know that gloves, when exposed to too much water, don't shrivel up all that much. Ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, the only piece of evidence that bore any weight at all was the possibility that O.J. claimed he didn't even own a pair of Bruno Mali shoes, and then someone produced a picture of him wearing a pair of them at a football game. Interestingly enough, the only person who would have really been able to verify the gloves and the shoes firsthand was Nicole Brown Simpson. The Dream Team never brought that up either. But see, that's all the thinking from the point of view of the presumption of innocence, like we're supposed to. Under the presumption of guilt, those things would have been damning. What the public heard seemed damning, but they didn't watch the trial. And I'm not going to convict a man to life in prison or death over the sole print of a pair of shoes. There's a lot more to it, though, as Paul Harvey would say. And now, the rest of the story. Question, did O.J. kill Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, and did the prosecutors make their case to actually prove anything against O.J. Simpson? The answers are, I saw no tangible certain evidence that could convict a man of a crime. There were perfectly logical explanations for all but a few minor points brought up by the prosecutors. Under the law and the standards of justice, I have to assume he is innocent, as specified in his jury verdict. And even better for me, I watched the whole trial. And it wasn't about fancy talk by the Dream Team. It was intelligence and good old research and elbow grease, getting down to the truth. After the fact, I was recently impressed with what Johnny Cochran said on CNN's Connie Chung Tonight program. Normally, when you ask a defense attorney whether their client was innocent or guilty, one of two things usually happens. The attorney declines comment, or the attorney declares the client's innocence. That's what a good attorney would do. It's not 100%, but it's fairly true. And I have a lot of respect for Cochran. I think he's got a great mind. Here's what Cochran said. I've got a link to the transcript of the interview in the text version of this. It's at the bottom of the page of that transcript. Connie Chung asked him, "Do you think he's innocent?" Cochran said, "I do. I think based upon what I knew of the facts of the case, he always maintained he was innocent, but you know, our team is such, everything he told us checked out. And really, the real reason was the timeline. I could never reconcile the timeline. If you believe the killings took place at about 10:40, 10:45, it would be almost impossible for him to have shed the clothes, do all those things, and be home, coming down the stairs to get into the limousine at 11:05. Connie Chung asked, "But you don't sound unequivocal about it." He said, "Based on what I know or what he told me." Cochran said, "Well, I always try to say I wasn't there. You know, I wasn't there that night." And Connie said, "Is that your wiggle room to get out?" Cochran said, no, I really don't. But I think based on everything I knew, I believe he's innocent because I think there was not enough time. And he always maintained that, and we never saw anything to the contrary. I really do, you know, as I said, it's so interesting when people have all these strong opinions. I said, "Well, how do you know you weren't there?" There's only about 3 or 4 people who know. And I think also it was very difficult for one person to have committed this crime in the fashion that it was committed. But you know. You can read the whole interview up there on the website. Then enter Alan Dershowitz. I recommend his books, Reasonable Doubts, The Criminal Justice System, and O.J. Simpson Trial. That book, by the way, they use the O.J. name to get out the information that he wants to tell you about, but it has very much more to do with the justice system as a whole. Short, expensive, and I found it in a bookstore in San Francisco for $3. Not like I mind paying for a good book. Anyway, Dershowitz exposes the use and definition of a very important word that's been made up called testifying. Now, testifying is when someone will say whatever it takes to prove their point. They think their opinions are so right that they'll lie to cause things to go their way, to get a conviction even when there's no evidence, because in their opinions, somebody committed a crime, and by golly, they're going to jail. They're going to be the cowboy in the movie who gets the bad guy no matter what. So police officers lie sometimes to make up for gaps in evidence. And no, I'm not saying it's all of them, and I'm not saying it's everywhere, but it happens a lot. And they conceal information and verbal reports of witnesses that would tend to prove the innocence of the defendant. A lot of that happened in the Simpson case. And like I said, the evidence was tainted. But even worse, there was a more sinister thread to the evidence, an officer named Mark Furman. Mark Furman was first at the scene of the crime, first at the Simpson home. He found the glove and he discovered the evidence in the Bronco. Furman had also been involved in a previous incident with O.J. and Nicole, a domestic dispute while they were still married. I won't go into that, but it sounded like there were a few bad nights. And people who do physical labor do generally express anger in what could be described as violent ways, especially verbally. Verbal violence. Crimes of passion often occur due to a short period of time of stress and anxiety and circumstances with people who would never otherwise consider committing violent acts towards other people. And this is not specific to OJ, it's just a common fact, a common thing that occurs in human beings. And then it began to surface in an uncorroborated report that Furman had said he was, well, let's say, zealous about harassing couples who are white and African-American. Furman took the stand and told his version of the story and his actions, and he was asked if he referred to African-Americans as niggers or used racial epithets. Furman adamantly denied any such possibility or occurrence. Then a tape recording from an interview is made available, clearly reproducing Furman using the word nigger. We soften the impact of it by using the phrase N-word now. All in all, the mountain of evidence supposedly compiled against Simpson had the credibility of a pile of trash. Yep, I have that opinion. But there was one more damning piece of DNA evidence that put the credibility of evidence in complete doubt. In initial investigations, no relative DNA evidence was found on that gate I first mentioned at Nicole Brown Simpson's residence. 3 weeks later, investigators found some blood evidence on the gate that might prove something about OJ's guilt or innocence. The problem was, tests showed that the blood had a preservative in it. ETA, I believe it's called. It's a preservative used by crime labs, among numerous other laboratories. And a reasonable person only conclude that it was planted after the fact. Because besides, a blood cell left outside on an iron gate affected by the weather as it would have been would not supply any active DNA that could be accurately tested. Did the prosecution prove the case? Not in the slightest. Is OJ guilty? Not by the standard of reasonable doubt under the law. And I find it unjust to have people be able to sue a person for a specific act when a court acquits you of wrongdoing. O.J. lost everything he had in a matter in which he was found not guilty. Somehow justice truly was not served in this case, no matter how you look at it. Now, it's possible that I may have said things in a way that's not 100% accurate, but I'd stand by about 99% of it. When I did my research to compile the report making, I went to various search engines and did a search on O.J. Simpson. 90% of what I got was on CNN, of course. So just save yourself the trouble and surrender to CNN and do a search up there on O.J. Simpson. It's all there, even transcripts. And on the search engines, you'll find 20 or 30 sites created by individuals like me who will tell you the same thing in much greater detail from their own points of view. With that, I'll conclude by saying, that's my version of the O.J. Simpson trial. And you don't have to take my word for it. I don't have to make this stuff up.